Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. Many believe there is 400 years of silence between the Old and New Testaments. My guest today is Professor George Athos, Director of Research and Senior Lecturer in Hebrew, Old Testament, and Early Church History at Moore Theological College in Sydney, Australia. He's the author of Bridging the Testaments, which covers four major periods, including Persian, Hellenistic, Hasmonean, and Roman. By studying the four centuries before Christ, you can gain key insights to help you understand both the Old and New Testaments, and you will discover that God was still speaking all the while. Here now is episode 557, Bridging the Testaments, with Dr. George Athos. Welcome to Restitutio, Professor. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, John. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Today, we're talking about your book, Bridging the Testaments, and it covers what many refer to as the intertestamental period. Now,
you don't care for that phrase,
do you? No. Why don't you start by just explaining why you don't like that phrase?
Yeah, I certainly don't. I feel almost dirty now that you've said it. It is a very common phrase, and it comes from this misperception, I would say, that there is a gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament, that there are 400 years of silence, prophetic silence, between the end of the Old Testament period and then the beginning of the New Testament period. And therefore, the testaments are kind of apart, and there is this intertestamental period where things happened, but we don't consider them biblical or really all that important. What I'm trying to do in the book is actually dispel this long-standing myth, but it is a myth, that these centuries were filled with prophetic silence. These centuries were anything but silent. God was, in fact, still active. And a lot of the biblical literature was actually written during this period. God was actually still doing things prophetically, bringing his plans to fruition. And a lot of what we read in the Old Testament was, in fact, written during these centuries. And so the Old Testament period, I would argue, goes all the way up to the first century when Jesus comes on the scene. And if I can put it rather starkly in two ways, no one in the New Testament believes that God has stopped speaking. None of the New Testament writers believe that there was this pause before their time. Somehow God fell off the airwaves or, you know, something like that. They, in fact, argued that there was a crescendo of prophetic activity. Jesus sees John the Baptist as, you know, the greatest of the prophets, and he's, you know, prophetic activity is ramping up all the way until John, and then Jesus comes on the scene. The other way I would put this rather starkly is to say that the events of the Gospels happen in the Old Testament period. They bring the Old Testament period to an end, and it's from there that we get the beginning of the New Testament period.
Okay. You might cover this in your introduction, but there is a verse in, I forget if it's first or second Maccabees, I'm sure you're familiar with it, where they said, oh, we can't decide on this until a prophet comes. And people point to that as evidence that, oh yeah, this is, God is silent during this period. So how would you respond to someone raising that objection?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting verse. It's from 1 Maccabees chapter 14, and it reflects something that happened in 140 BC. A couple of years earlier, in 142 BC, the Jewish nation gained its independence. It became independent of any other foreign power, which was the first time that it happened in centuries. The head of state was the last remaining Maccabee brother. There were five Maccabee brothers, and the last one standing was Simon, Simon Thassi. And he was the high priest, and he was given power as head of state as a high priest. The Jewish nation had to figure out what kind of power Simon had. This was a thorny question because not everyone believed in Judaism that the high priest should have civic authority over the whole nation, particularly because God had made promises to the Davidic dynasty. So if we go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, we see God's promises there to David that he would establish the house of David, that the house of David would then build Yahweh's house, build God's house. And the house of David, God himself, basically, if you follow the logic of 2 Samuel 7, God himself becomes a member of the Davidic dynasty. He is the eternal father figure of the Davidic dynasty. And so this is how God had chosen to govern his people. And so it was a non-negotiable. The Davidic dynasty was a given. And God had, through the prophets, promised that he would restore the Davidic dynasty, which had fallen when the Babylonians destroyed Judah in 586 BC.
Jeremiah.
Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Zechariah, you know, so many of the prophets talk about God's promises to reestablish a Davidic kingdom. The Davidic kingdom is identified as the kingdom of God. We read, for example, in 2 Chronicles that when Solomon, the son of David, comes to the throne, he sits on the throne of Yahweh. So the kingdom of David, the kingdom of God are identified as the same thing. And so there are many people in Judaism in 140 BC who believe that God is still going to make good on those promises and that they can't simply be set aside in favor of the situation that had prevailed in 140 BC, which is the high priest had taken civic authority. If you invested all power in the high priest, you were effectively saying that either God had changed his mind about his promises, and that raises questions about his trustworthiness, his faithfulness, and really the character of God comes into very sharp question if you abandon Davidic hope and invest all your hope in a priest. Simon, the high priest, was all for his own power and passing it on to his son. And so there seems to have been a lot of debate in Judaism as they kind of put together their new constitution as an independent nation. And there were those who were okay with Simon's power as an interim measure, but not as an ongoing in perpetuity measure. But Simon didn't want to, you know, give way to this idea of Davidic hope that there was still someone else to come, that God would send more prophets to guide the nation and change their constituency and the way they had configured their governance. And so he started to say, and his supporters started to say, that God wasn't sending any more prophets. He didn't need to, because Simon the high priest had fulfilled all of God's purposes, and you need look no further. There's no Messiah that you need to hope for. Simon is everything that we need. But there were those who were adamant, no, God will make good on his Davidic promises. And so a compromise was reached and a clause was inserted into the constitutional document, which we read in 1 Maccabees 14. And the clause says that Simon can rule the Jewish nation in perpetuity and pass power on to his son in perpetuity until a reliable prophet arises. And so in there, we hear that there are people there still believing that God is sending prophets. But of course, by saying reliable prophet, the powers at the time, Simon and his supporters, put a whole question mark over the phenomenon of prophecy and whether God was in fact going to be sending any more prophets. But we do know that God was indeed sending prophets during this time and continuing to guide the nations. Davidic hope did survive. And so by the time we get to the first century and we read in the Gospels what people are hoping for, they are still hoping for a Davidic Messiah. And so that's when John the Baptist comes along, and Jesus effectively identifies John the Baptist as that reliable prophet who would come to guide the nation in a new way. And of course, John the Baptist, when he did arrive on the scene, he pointed to someone else greater than him. That is the son of David, to Jesus, who was a Davidic descendant.
Very good. I love how you answered the question by laying out this thick context. And that's really the benefit, I think, of studying history, is that it gives us context so that we can avoid the error of cherry picking and just
exactly.
taking you know, a sound bite and then running with that in the wrong direction. You cover four main eras in the book, Before we get to those in any kind of depth, of course, our depth will be very limited in this conversation. I was just curious, what got you onto this? I mean, you're an Old Testament guy and a church history guy. That's already weird. But now you're also in this Persian, Hellenistic, Hasmonean, and Roman periods. What drew you there?
Well, Old Testament is my home base in terms of teaching. So that's, you know, that's where my first love is. I love the Old Testament.
Okay.
I love the New Testament too. It's one of my favorite Testaments as well. I teach predominantly Old Testament courses here at Moore Theological College in Sydney. And I teach a course on the book of Zechariah to my fourth year students. So they're in their senior year, the last year of their degree. And the book of Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah himself is in the late 6th century BC. He's part of the pioneering community that has come back from exile in Babylon to Jerusalem to rebuild under the leadership of the Davidic descendant Zerubbabel. But arguably, the book of Zechariah isn't just simply about that period. It actually covers a lot of ground over the next two centuries, all the way down to about 300 BC. As I, you know, I've been teaching this course for decades. And in interacting with my students, I realized that this period, the post-exilic period broadly, was a largely unknown period to my students. They didn't really have a very detailed understanding about what happened during these centuries. What were the theological developments that occurred? You know, I'd be talking about things and trying to explain, and they would always ask me, what's the one source that we can go back to? You know, what's the one book that we can consult to find out more about this period and its theological developments? And I'd have to send them to this book and that book, which did little bits and pieces. Or journal articles here and there. And in the end, I thought, why don't I just write the book? Because I don't think the book itself actually exists. And so I wrote the book. And as you say,
honestly,
it's
crazy
a big
it
book.
Doesn't. It's crazy it didn't already exist, right? I mean, we have how many books about the Old Testament studies, Old Testament theology, Old Testament history, and about the New Testament, probably twice as many. And
true.
What about that period in between? So,
well, it all comes back to that idea that these centuries were largely silent, and so we don't really need to worry about them very much. Unfortunately,
utterly false.
That's.
I mean, if your book
completely
proves
false.
One thing, it's that it wasn't silent during that period.
Yeah, and the irony is that it starts off as an anti-messianic idea. God is not going to send any more prophets because we're not going to be waiting for a Messiah. And so it was anti-prophetic, anti-messianic, and it was peddled by those who were in power, who were just simply protecting their own power. But ironically, as anti-messianic as it is, I still hear this idea from pulpits that God stopped sending prophets. And I don't know why we as Christians keep peddling this anti-messianic idea, which when you look at the New Testament, no one in the early church thought that way at all. No one.
Right. Yeah. The culprit could be these chronological Bibles or read the Bible in a year. And the student who's reading the Bible or just the churchgoer gets to the end of Malachi in the Protestant ordering and flips to Matthew chapter 1 and, you know, just assumes, blithely assumes, oh, well, you know, there's nothing in between, you know. So this is kind of a canonical issue as well. The Roman Catholic canon does have the books of Maccabees, so they kind of avoid that.
The Apocrypha.
So that's kind of interesting. Well, let's back up to the Persian period. And you know, obviously you can't go into great detail about all the politics of the period, but I guess in a brief way, could you just answer the question, how does learning about this period, the Persian period, how does it help us understand the Bible better?
It's a good question, Sean. The Persian period helps us to see that after the destruction of God's people, after they had lost their independence, been deported from their homeland, God was still wanting something to do with his covenant nation. He had every right to turn his back on them. There's nothing in the national covenant that obliges God to continue dealing with his people after they have been exiled. Exile is the big punishment under the covenant, and it spells the death of covenantal relationship. And the prophet Ezekiel picks that up. He pictures the restoration of the nation as a resurrection, that the, you know, valley of dry bones come together and form these actual, you know, bodies of flesh and blood that come to life once again. The nation has to be resuscitated, resurrected. And that's what God did in the post-exilic period, which is largely, or at least it begins with the Persian period. And the Persians were, in the first place, a very unexpected arrival in the ancient Near East. I use the line, you know, nobody expects the Persian Empire, because they weren't a traditional superpower at all. And so they took down the Babylonian Empire, but no one thought that they'd stay. But they do manage to establish a what I would call the first world empire, not just simply a regional empire, but a world empire that stretched across a vast amount of territory. And in doing so, and having one sovereign over that entire world empire, they brought a whole lot of people groups with various ways of thinking together under one governance structure. And so it became much easier to start exchanging ideas and to think in new ways. And so the Persians, who were kind of monotheistic, more or less, their way of thinking about their god, Ahura Mazda, as he was known, provided some good categories for Judeans to think about their own god and what they believed about their own god, and to affirm monotheism, the one god who is over all the nations, in a very similar way to the way that the Persian king was over all these nations. And so we see monotheism really start to gain traction, to flourish, to be assumed, rather than just, you know, you have to make an argument that there's only one god. They start to just assume there is only one God, and that is the God of Israel. That is the Judeans and Sumerians, their cousins in the north, the descendants of the northern kingdom of Israel. They all become, you know, fiercely monotheistic. And so the other thing that the Persians do is they are generally speaking quite well disposed towards the Judeans, because the way the Judeans thought about their god, Yahweh, was very similar to the way that Persians thought about their god, Ahura Mazda. And so the Judeans were able to flourish, but of course the Persians weren't about to give them their independence. And so there is this tension that arises in the Persian era about God raising the Persians up to enable his people to return and start to rebuild and work towards the fulfillment of God's promises, which ultimately is the re-establishment of a Davidic kingdom. But then the Persians become a problem in that, because a Davidic kingdom by necessity has to be independent. You can't have Persian overlords of a Davidic kingdom. It just doesn't make sense. God himself, being a member of the Davidic dynasty, can't be subservient to a foreign human king. So there's this interesting tension that arises. But one of the things that the Persians do is they are very centralized in terms of how they have power. All power is invested in the king, and the religion is centralized. And so this enables Judaism to become a very centralized religion. And this also creates a massive rivalry between the Judeans who are based in Jerusalem and the temple in Jerusalem. We need to remember the temple in Jerusalem is not just simply a place of worship. It's also a political monument to the Davidic dynasty, because only the Davidic king can build the temple. And so that's why Zerubbabel, who is the direct Davidic descendant, that's why he is the one who begins to rebuild the temple. There's this incongruence throughout the Persian period that they managed to rebuild the temple, which is a testament to God's commitment to David, and yet they don't have a Davidic king. They never get a Davidic king. Right. They have a Persian foreign king. But then the other half of the Israelite nation, the Sumerians, the descendants of the northern kingdom of Israel, they build a rival temple to God at a site called Mount Gerizim in the mountains of Samaria, central Samaria. And so there's this fierce rivalry between the two communities. And while the biblical literature never specifically mentions the temple on Mount Gerizim, It actually, once you know what's going on with the temple in Mount Gerizim, you actually see the biblical authors go out of their way to avoid mentioning the temple on Mount Gerizim. The way I like to put it is they aim to deliberately cast darkness on the temple on Mount Gerizim. They're not in denial that it's there. They just specifically want to cast darkness on it. And so there is this ongoing rivalry between Judeans in the south, Sumerians in the north, about who gets to define what it means to be Israel. And that kind of reaches a critical point in about 350 BC. And I would argue that part of Zechariah and all of the book of Malachi are about this. There is an attempt to reunite the Israelite nation. There was a short period when the Persians lost control of the region of Judah and Samaria, and everyone was declaring their independence. And so there was an attempt to reunify Israel, north and south, Judah and Samaria. And they even had the Edomites in on the deal as well, which is, you know, completely anathema to Malachi. But it was going to be a unified Israel under Sumerian leadership, which would deny Jerusalem, deny the Davidic promises, because the Sumerians, they have absolutely no regard for Davidic promises, a Davidic dynasty. They're not waiting for a Davidic Messiah at all. And yet they're the ones who are pushing this unification. Ultimately, it fails, but it shows you that there is this battle for who is going to define Israel. And if you get to define Israel, you get to define its theology and what it says about God. So the Persian period was really quite critical in developing the idea of one Israel under one God and raising the question, what is God doing about his Davidic promises?
Yeah. So knowing the context, the political context, not just of the Persian Empire in general, but how the Persian Empire affected Samaria and Jerusalem in particular, and those who are claiming to worship Yahweh, this is a great key to interpreting some of these Old Testament books that maybe we're reading in an exclusively spiritual sense and sort of ignoring the historical context, just out of ignorance probably. But let's move to the Hellenistic period. We do have Alexander the Great and his generals and the Seleucids and the Ptolemies in particular. How is studying them helpful for understanding the Bible as we read it?
I have a Greek heritage myself, so this is now warming the cockles of my heart to discuss this. So even though the Greeks get rather bad press in the Bible, and, you know, for good reason, theologically, there's a common misconception that Alexander the Great brings Greek influence to the Middle East, the ancient Near East. But the Greek influence began well before Alexander. I would say he's the one who really completes it rather than begins it, because there were Greeks within the Persian Empire. There were many, many Greek cities and Greek populations who were part of the Persian Empire. And so they were exchanging ideas. And, you know, the Greeks were the ones who were doing philosophy and drama, theater, and the sport and training of the gymnasium with its education aspect. And so those kinds of ideas and practices that we see from Greek philosophers and Greek leaders, they are already starting to influence the Judeans and Sumerians. Persia in the late 300s BC, the mid to late 300s BC, their control over their very vast empire is starting to become very brittle. And before that time, the world had kind of faced Mesopotamia, faced the city of Babylon, which was the biggest city in the Persian Empire and one of its four capitals. And the world was facing Mesopotamia, but throughout the course of the 4th century BC, the 300s BC, the world started to turn towards the Mediterranean. And that's because in about 400 BC, the Egyptians gained independence from Persia. The Persians always wanted them back and tried many times to conquer them. But the Egyptians became independent in about 400 BC. And by this stage, the great conflict between Persia and Greece had already started, you know, almost a century beforehand. And the Greeks in what's today mainland Greece and the Greek islands. They were, you know, very anti-Persian. So
right.
As soon as the Egyptians become independent, they're, you know, anti-Persian as well. The Greeks show up on the scene and essentially say to the Egyptians, hey, let's get together and
work
form
together.
This anti-Persian alliance. And so,
yeah.
And that basically creates a new center of magnetism between the Aegean world and Egypt. And the world begins to face in that direction, away from Persia, which is becoming weaker and weaker as time goes on. Alexander the Great eventually is the one who kills off the Persian Empire. He conquers the Persian Empire in a very stunning campaign. Within a decade, he's not only destroyed the Persian Empire, but he's conquered even more territories. But of course, he dies very suddenly in 323 BC, and his generals are left to figure out what they're going to do with this empire, because Alexander has no heir. His barbarian non-Greek wife is pregnant when he dies, but his generals are not about to allow a half-barbarian child to become their ruler. And so the empire that Alexander had conquered within a few decades essentially crumbles into smaller pieces, and his generals, his staffers, come to rule these pieces as independent kingdoms. Two of those kingdoms are really important for understanding Judaism at the time. They are the Ptolemies, who are ruling in Egypt. The most famous Ptolemy is Cleopatra of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. Yeah, Cleopatra the Seventh.
The seventh, right?
Actually, yeah.
But there are many Cleopatras, right?
Yes, there are. That's right.
Ptolemies.
So the Ptolemies are a Greek dynasty that are ruling Egypt. And so Greek culture, Greek thinking, Greek education, ideas, religion, research, they are booming, especially in the city of Alexandria, which Alexander founded. The other kingdom is the Seleucid Kingdom, which is pretty much based in Syria. Again, a Greek dynasty that is ruling this territory of Syria, and Judah, or Judea as the Greeks call it. Judea and Samaria are essentially the rope in a tug of war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids.
Okay.
You can read all about this in Daniel's last vision, Daniel 10 to 12. And there is constant warfare. Just in the 4th century BC, sovereignty over Jerusalem changed 10 times, and that's just one century.
Wow.
And then in the following couple of centuries, the Ptolemies and Seleucids fought, it depends how you count them, but they fought probably 7 wars over who owns Judea and Samaria, amongst other territories. The Greeks are really important because they bring their philosophical way of thinking to Judaism. And Judaism looks at these ideas and is able to adapt them to their ways of thinking about their own religion. I think the most influential aspect of that was Platonic philosophy. So the philosopher Plato, who lived in the 300s BC, his philosophical school of thought was very influential in Judaism. And Judaism adopted his way of thinking, but adapted it. They adopted it and adapted it to a specifically Jewish way of thinking. And they developed what we would call apocalyptic thinking. This idea that what we see in the world, the mundane world in which we all live, it's not all there is. There's a spiritual reality behind the physical world that we know. And it's a spiritual world that's actually more real than this physical world. And it governs what happens in this physical world. That way of thinking influences Judaism for centuries thereafter. It becomes a standard way of thinking. When we get to the New Testament, every New Testament writer thinks in this way. They've adapted these categories, and this is how they view the world. Jesus himself uses this apocalyptic way of thinking. For example, just to pick one example, in the Lord's Prayer, he says, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So on earth, in this mundane physical world, may your will be done as it is in heaven, in the spiritual world. And so that there's an alignment between the spiritual world and the physical world, so that God's will may be achieved. And of course, you know, in the Gospels in the first century, Jesus is addressing people, and with the Lord's Prayer, his disciples, who are earnestly expecting the fulfillment of God's purposes in a Davidic kingdom. And they've put all their hope in Jesus as the Davidic descendant who will bring about this kingdom. So the Greeks were highly influential. And some of the events that are in this Hellenistic period, as we call it, they're mentioned in the Old Testament. But because we think this period is very silent, we fail to see that. We think that the biblical literature must be referring to stuff that's much earlier. But no, there's a lot of biblical literature that is about things that are happening in the Hellenistic era. One of the, I think, most important events that happens in the Hellenistic era, which is discussed in the prophetic books, mainly in the book of Zechariah, but also we see some allusions in the book of Isaiah. Ptolemy the First besieged Jerusalem in 301 BC. He captured the city, got sovereignty over Judea in this way. But he then deported a whole lot of Jews down to Alexandria. This is how the Jewish community in Alexandria begins and very quickly becomes the biggest Jewish community in the world at the time. And so effectively, there's another exile. And the Zechariah 12 to 14, the last oracle in the book of Zechariah, is all about these events and seeing the catastrophe that it was and trying to imagine God correcting the dystopia that had developed as a result of this. And so the book of Zechariah goes from a return from exile in Babylon and the high hopes of restoration to ending with another exile, this time off to Egypt, and the loss of hope. And they come to a point, and the book of Zechariah, I think, is very important in this way. They don't know how God is going to achieve his purposes.
Let's talk about the next period, the Hasmonean period. I think a lot of us are maybe a little more familiar with this because of Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. I live in New York, so there's lots of Hanukkah celebrations. Yeah. We have lots of Jewish people.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the Hasmonean period is really fascinating. And why is this period in particular of Judean, I don't even want to necessarily say independence, but the struggle for independence, and then depending on how you count it, and then the subsequent kingdom, it's not really a kingdom, it's a priestdom, isn't it? How does this help us understand the context of the Bible?
Yeah, it does become a kingdom eventually. Yeah, it's a very interesting period because Greek religion is, in contrast to the Persians, the Greeks and their religion were very decentralized. The Greeks were never a united people. They were made up of all these various city-states, which were constantly at war with each other. You know, Athens and Sparta are perhaps the most famous of them, but there were so many Greek city-states warring with each other. And religion was decentralized. There was no sense that all Greeks had to worship at one place at one time, in one way, with one priest. Anyone could be a priest, and you could worship in whatever way was acceptable to the gods. It was very decentralized. And so as Greek influence came to Judea, the idea of decentralization is it's interesting how that idea starts to blend with Judaism, which is highly centralized. Judaism must have one leader at this particular time. Under the Seleucids, that the Greek dynasty that ruled Syria, they initially were very good towards the Jews once they had conquered the area off the Ptolemies. They gave the Jews a lot of latitude. This is 198 BC onwards. And with that latitude, Jews started to ask the question, well, what is Israel? What does it mean to be a Jew and to be worshiping God in Jerusalem? Who gets to define that? And so there were a lot of different groups that arose. This is the period in which we see the rise of such groups as the Sadducees, who are essentially a priestly group. We see the rise of the Essenes, who eventually are the sect that settle at Qumran, and we have the Dead Sea Scrolls from them, and the Pharisees as well. They are a group that start to become prominent at this particular time. And so there's this tension about who gets to define Judaism. Is it the ultra-conservatives like the Pharisees? Is it the mild conservatives, kind of the Essenes, or is it the Sadducees at the time were kind of conservative as well? By the time we get to the New Testament, they're actually very progressive and liberal. There are also a lot of Hellenizers, as they're called, people who are very willing to embrace Greek ideals in all their vastness. And so, for example, they start to identify their own god Yahweh with the Greek god Zeus.
Right.
And that has theological implications about, you know, how can the character of Zeus, who, when you read Greek mythology, this god is, there's not a lot that's morally impressive about him. And yet Yahweh is a perfect God, a holy God, full of justice and truth and faithfulness, etc. And so there's a lot of theological tension that starts to build at this time. Eventually we get to one particular Seleucid king, Antiochus IV. And this guy was really nasty. He was a megalomaniac. He had big tickets on himself. He wanted to conquer Egypt and join it to his kingdom and outdo Alexander and take on the Romans and all this kind of stuff. And eventually he intervened. He needs a lot of money to do this. And so he eventually tries to get his hands on the money that's in the temple in Jerusalem. The liberal Jews are the ones who are at the time in power. The Seleucids really favor them. And by giving them more and more power, they effectively decide that it's the liberal progressive factions in Judaism that will have the right to define Judaism. When we look at what those particular leaders were doing, especially people like the high priest himself, Menelaus, they are selling out to Greek culture and religion.
Oh, yeah.
They are, you know, Menelaus is very happy to send donations to worshipping the god Hercules and the demigod Hercules and all this kind of thing. And that causes an absolute outrage in Judaism. Eventually, the things reach ahead. Breaking point in 167 BC, and there is a massacre of people in Jerusalem that Antiochus instigates, and the conservatives and ultra-conservatives flee Jerusalem at this point, 167 BC. Some of those who fled were a group of five brothers and their father, we know them as the Hasmonean family, and they start to build a kind of very small-time guerrilla warfare-style resistance movement, which they eventually call the Maccabees. And they're called the Maccabees after the code name of one of the five brothers, Judas Maccabee. In Hebrew, the word Maccabee means hammer. And so Judas's code name, yeah, exactly. Judas's code, they all had code names, very cool code names. But Judas was the hammer. He was the military brains of the operation. And so all the resistance fighters from then on were called Maccabees. And they are surprisingly successful. They know how to take the Seleucids down, but they also take down the liberal Jews as well. They put them in the same basket as the Gentile Greeks, the Seleucids. The Seleucid authorities, though, eventually realize that they need to stamp out the Maccabees. And so they send, you know, a massive force to put them down. And they're lining up for a battle in November 164 BC. And the Maccabees have no hope of winning this battle. It is very clear that they are going to lose this battle and their resistance movement will be snuffed out.
Right.
And Judea will continue to be ruled by or governed by liberal people who are very much in favor of Greek ideals. But just before the battle occurs, the Seleucid commander receives news that the Seleucid king, Antiochus IV, has died in another country on the edge of the Seleucid Empire. And in order to secure the succession of the throne, he abandons the war and he ends up going back to the Seleucid capital in Antioch. And suddenly the Maccabees,
they're uncontested.
They see this as, yeah, they see this as a victory, you know, instigated by divine intervention. And so they march on Jerusalem. They capture part of Jerusalem. They can't capture all of it. For the next 20 or so years, Jerusalem is largely a divided city. There's still a Seleucid garrison there in the city holding out. the resistance movement, again, it kind of ebbs and flows. It, gains momentum and then it takes a step back. And Judas Maccabeus himself in 160 BC, he's killed in battle. And that looks like the absolute end of the movement. But his two remaining brothers, Jonathan and Simon, they are able to take up the mantle. And at this point, the Seleucid kingdom starts to descend into civil war as people are trying to gain the throne. And Jonathan, one of the surviving Maccabee brothers, he's able to play off the different claimants to the Seleucid throne, play them off each other to gain concessions for himself and for the Jews. Before we know it, the Jews are on the verge of independence, having an independent kingdom. Jonathan is ultimately betrayed by a Seleucid and he's murdered in 143 BC. But the following year, his brother Simon, the last Maccabee brother, gains independence for the Jewish nation. And he becomes the ruler of the Jewish nation, but not as a king, rather as a high priest. And so we're back to, the first question that you asked about, forming a constitution. People are now having to ask the question, what kind of power should our ruler have if especially we are waiting for a Davidic king to arrive? What are our prophets going to tell us? There's no sense that God had stopped speaking. It's from this point onwards that those who are in power, they now start to suggest, no, God has stopped speaking. He's not sending any more prophets. We've reached the fulfillment of God's purposes for Israel. We are now effectively a kingdom of priests, or rather the kingdom of a high priest who is head of state. And so there's this tension that starts to build between those who largely ordinary folk, lay people, who are still hoping for a Davidic kingdom, and those who now occupy the corridors of power, who are saying, Simon as a high priest, that's all we need. And so Judaism starts to develop as a hierocracy, a nation that is ruled by a priest, but you've got a large portion of society waiting for a Davidic king to arrive. A couple of generations later, Simon's dynasty, Aristobulus, who is Simon's grandson, declares himself king of the Jews. And so what we see at this point is the Hasmoneans who had, the Hasmonean family, the Maccabees, who had been so against the establishment of Greek ideals within Judaism and fighting against the Seleucids, they have now effectively become a Hellenistic kingdom themselves.
Right. And you can tell by the names, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, the Greek names had stuck, crept in much earlier. But
before long, there's a king named Alexander ruling over the Jews.
That's right. Yeah. Aristobulus' brother, Alexander Janaeus. He has two names. He has a Greek name and he has an Aramaic name. So he's known, to Jews as King Jonathan. Janaeus is kind of a short Aramaic form of the name Jonathan. And to the rest of the world, the Greek world, he's King Alexander. We see there the blending of Greek ideals and Jewish ideals in the people of the Hasmonean dynasty. And they hold power up until the time that the Romans come on the scene, which is in 63 BC. Everything that's going on in Judea is embroiled with other events and currents that are happening in the rest of the Mediterranean world. And that's one of the things I try to capture in the book, in Bridging the Testaments, that you have to know what's going on in the wider Greco-Roman world to understand what's going on within Judaism. And if you don't, you kind of miss the significance of what is going on in Judaism. And when we miss that significance, we're missing out on so much when we come to the Gospels. So, for example, just the statement in the Constitution that the Simon the high priest can rule until there is a reliable prophet. Well, that's John the Baptist. And if you don't know that that clause had gotten into the Constitution, you'd know John the Baptist is important, but you wouldn't realize just how important he is and why he was deemed such a threat to those who were in power, to the chief priests who ruled the temple, to Herod Antipas, who ruled Galilee and Perea. And it also explains why Jesus has a showdown with the priests during the last week of his ministry. He rides into Jerusalem. He's acclaimed son of David. He goes into the temple, which is run by the priests, and says, "Tear this place down, I'll build a new temple." He overturns the tables of the money changers, and the next day the priests are there asking him, "By whose authority are you doing these things?" And Jesus very cleverly doesn't just give them a straight answer. And he doesn't just simply pose this interesting, curious academic riddle.
It's not just a riddle, yeah.
Yeah, he says, "Well, you tell me, by whose authority did John the Baptist say what he said?" Remembering that actually John the Baptist is the prophet, the reliable prophet who would come to point the nation in a new direction. And at this point, the priests themselves, if they say John the Baptist is a prophet, they have to say, "Well, okay, we've got to give up our own power and we'll hand it over to you, Jesus." But of course, they're not about to do that, but they don't want to offend the people because the people will turn on them because they believe John was not just simply a prophet, but that prophet, the trustworthy prophet who would arise. And if that's who John the Baptist is, then it implies Jesus is the Messiah. It's a very clever question that Jesus puts to them. And of
and
course,
we miss
they
all
avoid
of this if we don't have the knowledge of the period before
precisely.
The time of Christ.
Exactly.
Well, we don't really have time to get into the Roman period, but there's lots of interesting events that occur there. You have Antipater, Herod, and his chaos. And you go into that a little bit. So one thing I was thinking about, I wonder if you would agree, is that the names of the disciples, they seem to me very Hasmonean. And, like Simon and Judas and even Matthew sounds to me like the original.
Yeah,
right?
Mattathias, yeah.
Mattathias, yeah. And so would you say then that people are naming their kids after these independence fighting heroes because they're feeling like the Romans need to get, somebody needs to Hasmonean those or Maccabee those Romans.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's interesting that everyone wanted the Romans to go. Very few Jews wanted to collaborate with the Romans. It was really those who were in power, the Caiaphases and the Annases, who were okay with the Romans because the Romans essentially propped up their authority. But the average Jew wanted the Romans to go. And when we look at how the Romans gained sovereignty over the Jews in Judea and Galilee really suffered quite significantly. The Romans initially were friends of the Jews, but once they gained sovereignty, things changed quite dramatically. Jews in the rest of the Roman Empire actually fared reasonably well, but not in Judea and Galilee. When we read the Gospels, I think we have this view that the Jews were wanting a political Messiah to give them political independence. And we kind of shake our heads and say, "Oh, those silly people, they shouldn't have been thinking about that. They really needed a spiritual Messiah. That's really what they needed, and that's what Jesus was." That, I think, is a mistake. What Jesus does is very political. Jesus is the Son of David, come to establish a kingdom of God. And that is not just simply a spiritual entity. It is something that is meant to make a difference in the mundane world. Jesus is not just a spiritual guru who kind of is an impressive life coach.
Yeah, spitting
he's
out
the Messiah.
One-liner aphorisms. It's
yeah,
it's deeper
exactly.
Than that.
And Jesus is inhabiting the world of the Psalms, where the King is the one who puts an end to the enemies of his people and the enemies of God. And this is what everyone's hoping for. And Jesus fulfills that role. He just does it in a very surprising way because he doesn't pick up a sword to do it. On the contrary, he gives his own life. He's then raised from the dead, ascends into heaven, and is seated at the right hand of God the Father, from where he's given all authority in heaven and on earth. He doesn't need to pick up a sword. So Jesus does become the king
the enthroned Messiah.
That's right. The summary of the gospel message is Jesus is Lord. The other flip side of that is Caesar is not Lord. You can treat Caesar in a particular way, but he is not Lord. Jesus is Lord. And this is the message that is going to transform the world. And so the disciples, their names, they're living in a Greco-Roman world. Some of them are from Greek cities. So Peter, Simon Peter. Simon has a Hebrew name, Simon Shimon, but his brother Andrew has a Greek name. Their friend Philip has a Greek name. They are all from the city of Bethsaida. That was its Jewish name. Its Greek name was Julius. It was actually a Greek polis. And so, you know, they were speaking Greek fairly fluently. That's why in, what is it, John chapter 12, in the last week of Jesus's ministry, some Greeks come to the temple in Jerusalem, right, and they find Philip and they say, we want to chat with Jesus, please. And, so, you know, they're having this conversation in Greek, yeah, and Jesus speaks Greek out too. Yeah, the conversation that Jesus has with Nicodemus in John chapter 3, it only makes sense in Greek, this misunderstanding about is it born from above or born again? You know, what Nicodemus has a misunderstanding. There's no such misunderstanding if the conversation occurs in Aramaic or Hebrew, but it does occur in Greek. So, you know, even Jesus himself is comfortable speaking Greek. And so, yeah, the whole of Judaism and Jesus is in a circle. They are looking for the redemption of Israel, the overthrow of God's, the enemies of God's people, and the establishment of something new. But Jesus does it without a sword.
Very good. Well, there's just so much that we didn't get a chance to talk about, so much with the Samaritans and a lot of other events that you skipped over. You really just gave the barest scratching of the surface of what you cover in the book, and yet we're already out of time. Let me ask you this. For those who are interested, you know, obviously they can get the book. It's called Bridging the Testaments, published by Zondervan Academic. How else can people follow your work?
They can get online and go to academia.edu. If you search my name there at academia.edu, you'll find a lot of my other publications and research there. That's probably the best way to do it.
Okay, very good. Anything else, final concluding thoughts you have before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I want to encourage people just to put to bed finally this idea that there were four centuries of silence. It's unbiblical. Please stop peddling this from the pulpits. Grab my book. I'd love you to read my book and see the evidence for that, and also just the richness of the Old Testament. Once that idea is put aside, it actually frees us to understand the Old Testament in a far deeper, far better way. And that sets us up to understand the Gospels in a much deeper way as well. So I commend the book to your viewers.
Very good. Well, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Well, that brings this episode to an end. What did you think? Does it make you want to study this period more? I hope it does. I hope it does. I hope you're just going to be thinking about Persians and Greeks and the Maccabean Revolution and the Hasmoneans that came out of that, and the Romans, especially this period leading up to the time of Christ. A lot of times we focus on the Roman Empire from the time of the Apostle Paul, like in the 50s and the 60s AD, but there's a whole backstory of how in the world Herod even got to be in charge and how terrible he was and what Pontius Pilate was about and what he was doing. So I encourage you, I think the more you study the history surrounding the Bible, the better you understand the Bible. So I encourage you to look into this further. If you have thoughts and questions or comments, go to restitutio.org, find episode 557, Bridging the Testaments, and leave your comments and questions there. In a previous episode, 551, Read the Bible for Yourself, part 18, where I went over some helpful tools to understand the Bible, I talked some about biblical languages. Suzanne wrote in saying, Sean, I'm so glad you spoke about the biblical languages. Of course, many people don't have the time, patience, or aptitude to grasp Hebrew or Greek. I've been working on learning biblical Hebrew now for a few years, quite steadily, and I'm barely beginning. Thank you also for mentioning Daily Dose of Hebrew. I listen to it religiously every day. And Aleph with Beth. I think I have spent hundreds of hours on that site. My objective is 1 hour a day.
What's great about Beth and Andrew, Americans living in Mexico teaching biblical Hebrew, is that the first 100 or so videos covers something like 95% of all the words in the Old Testament that are used 500 times or more. In other words, all the main words. Let me just break in here, Suzanne. Also, Andrew Case has his own podcast on translations called Working for the Word, a Bible translation podcast. And it's really good. He talks a lot about interesting translation issues that come up as a translation consultant, working with people who are translating the Bible into less common languages and the struggles that they face with. But he also has a lot of other stuff. He actually has a really interesting book on the name of God, Yahweh, and going through a lot of Nehemiah Gordon's material and refuting his suggested Yehovah translation. So that's, I know, a juicy topic for people that are into sacred name stuff. But anyhow, Suzanne goes on, thanks again, Sean. I also would recommend Tim McNinch's videos, especially the alphabet. He teaches you a good song to memorize that and all his verb conjugation ones. Well, there you have it. Also, my guest today, George Athas, is a Hebrew expert and was involved in the BHS Reader's Edition of the Old Testament, I believe. And that is where you have the text unadorned with English words all around it, like in an interlinear, is very actually hard to read because you can't not see the English. So whereas a reader would just give you the Hebrew text, but then words that are used less frequently will have footnotes at the bottom of the page with short, helpful definitions. So that is a tool that I use. I actually have the Reader's Edition of the whole Bible. So it has the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament and, you know, the less commonly used words on the bottom of each page. So, yeah, I definitely am a big believer in that, though I typically just end up reading in my Bible software on like a daily basis or either on my PC, Accordance, or on my phone. I use Logos on my phone. So, however you're going to do it, if you're into the languages, I highly recommend it. You know, history really helps us understand the Bible. Studying the biblical languages really helps us understand the Bible. And all of this is in an effort to restore authentic Christianity and live it out today. So thanks, everybody, for listening to the end. May God bless you as you continue to seek and dig out the treasures of truth contained in the Scriptures. That's going to be it for this week. If you'd like to support this ministry, you can do that at restitutio.org. We'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.